Hello and welcome to the Funds Fanatic Show. I'm very pleased to be joined on the podcast and in the studio today by Tim Guinness. Tim is the founder and chairman of Guinness Global Investors. And in fact, this is his second time around, having previously founded Guinness Flight, which was sold to Investec in 1998. Still active as a fund manager today, he works on the £417 million Guinness Global Energy Fund and several other portfolios. Tim, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Jeff.
Now, Tim, you've seen a few bear markets in your career, not to put too fine a point in it. I suppose, how do you think about downturns as an investor?
I started in the city in 1970, and 3 years after I'd done that, I was in a corporate finance department, and I find myself having to work on rescuing Burma Oil.
Wow.
Now, this was in the 1973 stock market crash, and their biggest shareholding was a stake in BP. And I was quite shocked when I found myself pointing out to my director that the BP share price had halved, and because the oil price was surging, its price-earnings ratio had got to 1.6 times. Of course, over the next few years, BP recovered actually hugely, and it ended up, I think at the bottom it had gone to £2.50, and it ended up at £20. And so that taught me that investors can be a bit irrational during bear market crashes. Another experience was with a fund I launched that tracked the Wired Index. This was in 1998, about November, I think, and the Wired Index was an index created by Wired magazine that was investing in 40 stocks in the new economy.
Right.
Internet, global communications, and so on. Now, the timing of the launch was pretty good. Markets were very strong in 1999 and through to the middle of 2000. Then what happened? We had another crash. And everything plummeted. And we were holding our heads in our hands, and then things slowly recovered. And I remember doing the maths, because I set up my existing company, Guinness Asset Management, in 2003. And we were taking over the management of this fund. And I looked at its performance from November 1998 through to January 2003. And that had covered the rise and the fall and then the recovery. And the extraordinary thing was that the fund, the NASDAQ and the S&P, which had all diverged quite significantly at various times over that period, had ended up in exactly the same place at zero. So that taught me that, you know, what goes up comes down and then recovers. So that's my attitude when I'm thinking about the stock market, bear market that we're currently experiencing. To investors is, you know, don't panic.
Right.
What goes down comes up. And I guess another thing that I would say to investors.
Yeah.
And perhaps I should add is that I'm basically a long-term investor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in once having a conversation, you need to establish whether the person you're talking to has got a short, medium, or long-term time horizon.
Right.
I believe that equity investing is principally suitable for the long-term investor who wants to preserve the real value of his wealth and grow it over time. Then I'm going to share with you a conversation I had with a cousin of mine. Who was a very good investor, and he said to me, the only thing you need to do, Tim, is to invest at the bottom of a bear market and then wait for 10 or 20 years and then sell at the top.
Sounds good.
I've always thought about this, but actually I think it is quite difficult, and I've concluded I don't necessarily have that skill set. So I'm more the investor, I'll ride out the storm.
Okay.
And I think there's a couple of other big picture things I want to share
with you
about equity investing.
Mm.
In the early 1920s, and I'm not sure how many people have thought about the early 1920s much. The only German investors who really came through unscathed from a huge inflationary bout that they had then were those investing in equities. And then, but I've got to be careful of being too bullish, because I will admit that if you invested at the top of the 1929 bull market, you did have to wait 24 years until 1954 until you had recovered the real value of your investment. However, I'm a long-term investor, and had you then continued to hold, over the next 60 years, you would have seen your investment go up 9 times in real terms, and you'd have got the dividends on top.
Right.
So as you can tell, I'm not a market timer.
Yeah. Well, I suppose that, you know, that brings me on to the next thing I was going to ask. I mean, maybe in a way it's best to disregard this question, but I suppose I was going to say, where do you think we're at in the current downturn? I mean, the news flow, particularly in the UK, just seems to get worse and worse.
Okay. Now, I love this sort of question, and I do have views. And I think it's pretty simple, really. We are in the 11th bear market since World War II. And I think we can learn something from looking at the previous 10 bear markets. And I've done that, and I have concluded that this bear market is going to end on March the 27th, 2023. And it's going to hit, I follow the S&P 500 mainly, it's going to hit 3,287.
Okay.
I'm joking. Okay. And I think it's very important that we all remember that anyone who tells you that they know where the price of the stock market is going is probably both a liar and definitely a thief.
Or at least some kind of salesman.
Exactly. But anyway, why did I come up with those dates and the level to which I think the market could reasonably go to?
Yeah.
Well, I looked at the 10 previous bear market declines. I decided to exclude the two very shallowest, where the market only went down about 20%, and the very sharp one in 1987 when it crashed and then recovered in about 2 months. And I looked at the other 7, and the average length of those bear markets was 15 months. So it's dead easy. When did this bear market start? December the 27th, 2021. And so that's how we get to March the 27th of 2023. Mm. What about the decline? Why am I telling you it's going to bottom? You know, the S&P is today around 3,600. For those who don't follow the S&P, it peaked at about 4,800, and so it's down 25%. When I look at the bear markets I've referred to, the 10 bear markets, there are 3 pretty bad ones where the market fell 50%, more or less. And we've got 1973-4, which was a banking crisis, and there were lots of things went wrong in 1973-4, and I'll talk a little bit about that. Mm-hmm. We had 2000, what I would call a stock market bubble crash, and then we had 2008, another banking crisis. So I got those 3, and then I've got another 4 where the market fell sort of 25 to 33%. And I am cautiously saying that I think we're in that category of bear market. I'm also, I've always loved looking at Fibonacci. Now, I'm not a chartist.
1 + 1 + 2 + 3
exactly,
plus 5,
yeah. Exactly. And the golden mean. And those who follow Fibonacci wearing a chartist hat, to repeat, I'm not a chartist, but I do look at it. Because it tells you, I think, something about the behavior of crowds.
By chartists, you're talking about technical analysis.
Yes. But this is just very big picture.
Yeah.
And the Fibonacci, the people who like looking at Fibonacci movements. They look at retracements, and they like when a market retraces by about 32% of its rise from the previous bottom, that's a Fibonacci point. And when it retraces 62% or 61.8% to be precise, that's a pretty important support point. And that's where my 3,287 comes from. Of course, this may be a more serious bear market. Why I am not putting it into the worst category, although there are similarities with 1973, but perhaps I will touch on. In 1973, we had a war. We had the Arab-Israeli war. We got Ukraine. We had foreign exchange market dislocation. We just the Bretton Woods Agreement had just come to basically broken down. The US dollar had left the gold standard, just like we've seen quite wild fluctuations in exchange rates recently. Yeah. Although there was quite an important difference back in 73, the US dollar weakened, and of course this time around it strengthened. We also were seeing an energy price spike.
Yeah.
And so those are similarities. What are some of the differences? Well, I think 1973, we were really sitting, we'd been in a bull market for about 24 years.
Yeah.
If you look at the charts, you go back to 1947 and the market, okay, it had corrections, but so it was pretty extended, whereas we've really only been going for 12 or so years since 2009. Secondly, if I look at the US economy, at housing starts and vehicle manufacturing statistics, housing starts are not overextended. They're running sort of around the average 1.5 million a year, which, by the way, interesting, in America, housing starts have run at for about 60 years. In fact, I'll digress for a second on that.
Okay.
Because I wondered how this could be the case when I first came across it, when I was looking, funnily enough, in 2008 at what was going on.
Right. And so this is the number of new homes that are starting to be built.
Correct.
Right.
And it's a little bit larger than the number of net new homes, because some homes are knocked down every year.
Okay. Anyway,
just it's a round number. And back in 1960, the US population was growing at 3 million a year.
Mm.
And today it's been growing at about 3 million a year. Again, I scratched my head, but actually it was growing back then at 2%, and now it's growing at 1%. So there you go. So housing starts have run for a very long time at about half the number of the growth in the population headcount.
Mm.
I sort of understand that, two people per house. Anyway, we are in the middle of the range, which historically has ranged between 1 million and 2 million a year. We're at 1.5. And again, vehicle manufacturing statistics, they've been depressed because of COVID and so on. So that there's not that. And household balance sheets are in reasonable shape.
Okay.
Now, of course, we know government balance sheets aren't in that good shape. But they weren't that strong either back in 1973. I mean, we were still recovering from World War II.
Anyway, yeah.
For better or worse, that's...
Okay, that's the case for some optimism, I suppose.
Yeah, correct.
If I can just come back to that point about government balance sheets, Tim. I mean, you know, we're speaking a few days after Jeremy Hunt's become Chancellor, and I think the day after... he's basically reversed lots of the tax cuts in the mini budget, which precipitated this huge sell off in the gilt market and this crisis for pension funds. I mean, I suppose you know, with your experience, I mean, what do you think has gone quite so wrong there, and who's to blame?
I think you're asking me mainly about the pension fund.
Yes, I suppose, yes. Yes. Aside from what seems to be, you know, political mismanagement. Yeah, I suppose, what do you think has gone wrong on the investing side there? How have pension funds ended up in this situation?
Political mismanagement. Mm. Maybe it's the journalist profession has got it wrong, but that's another matter.
Okay.
Oh, sorry, I shouldn't have said that. No. On the LDI crisis, I mean, I tear my hair out.
Mm.
There are a number of scapegoats.
Right.
None of them include, in my view, Kwasi or Lizzie.
Okay.
I think the number one person who should be taking responsibility is the current governor of the Bank of England.
And Andrew Bailey.
Andrew Bailey. And I'm picking on him because he has been in a senior regulatory position for the whole of the last 10 years.
Right. He was head of the FCA.
The FCA, precisely, and now head of the Bank of England. And basically warnings that were given to the Bank of England, inter alia, about the LDI potential problems, were completely ignored.
Okay.
And then we put him up there, and then we quite close to him, I put the actuarial profession. It never ceases to amaze me their lack of proper understanding of risk, by the way.
Okay.
And the whole system has got obsessed by short-term volatility. By the way, which in this case they've not properly taken into account. It's another ironic thing.
Right.
But, I mean, they don't understand it. So the actuaries and next people in the my rifle.
Okay.
And then I suppose you have to blame up to a point the pension fund trustees, but I blame them less because they're not the experts, although they could have asked more questions.
Right.
Or some, like Simon Wolfston, did.
Mm. Okay. And so just to, you know, so LDI, liability driven investing, you know, in essence, to radically simplify things, these are massive pension funds using derivatives to try and meet their liabilities. In essence, it's the same as using leverage to increase their gilt exposure, which has a lot of negative consequences when gilts sell off rapidly.
Correct. But I think there's another thing to make here.
Yeah.
It's very odd to me that the regulatory system didn't want, once the problem began to emerge, say what we need here is liquidity. These were not solvency problems.
Right.
They were liquidity issues. And I mean, you know, pension funds basically are financially very strong. What they had was a very short-term liquidity problem.
Yeah.
They couldn't meet the margin calls.
Mm. And, you know, Terry Smith wrote in the FT that he thinks a lot of the problem is pension funds are investing in the wrong assets. They should be investing for long-term growth in equities. What do you think?
On this, Terry and I are shoulder to shoulder.
Okay.
He's completely right.
Right.
And I think he made the point that some pension fund he was involved in, he'd invested in, you know, 20 good quality
that was
stocks.
The precursor to Fundsmith Equity. Yeah.
Yeah, and this is very basically much our approach, as I will get on to possibly later.
Okay.
Depending on how your interrogation goes.
Well, let's get on to that now, Tim. So as I referenced in the intro, you've set up two different asset management businesses, at least two, I should probably say. I suppose when you were starting Guinness Asset Management, Guinness Global Investors, 20 or so years ago, why did you want to do it again?
Right, an interesting question. I suppose there are several quite simple reasons. The success I had with Guinness Flight, and by the way, here it would be remiss of me not to mention the contribution of Howard Flight, now Lord Flight, who was my business partner throughout most of that period, and his contribution. Anyway, that was a success that was enough in financial terms to enable me to buy a nice house in London and a nice house in Italy. However, it didn't leave me with enough funds to enjoy the lifestyle to which these new mansions really required me to have. Secondly, I was much too young to retire. And anyway, I didn't want to.
Yeah.
I enjoy the investment business.
Mm.
Which I think is perhaps an important point. You only live once.
What do you particularly enjoy about it?
I'm a curious person. And I enjoy looking at the rise and fall of different business models and industries.
Yeah.
I enjoy thinking about economics, particularly on a very long-term basis. I also find that if you are lucky enough to work with agreeable colleagues, you can have a good working environment. And of course, perhaps it's worth making the point that once I set up my own company, I was very much in control of that.
Yeah.
And that was something, that was an objective I very much had. Try and assemble over time a team of intelligent, hardworking, total integrity, agreeable and energetic people. Those are my sort of mantras.
And yeah,
more or less, I hope I've achieved that. I mentioned Howard Flight. I suppose in all of us, there's a bit of, I wanted to prove that I could do it alone.
Okay.
I am more of an entrepreneur, I think, than perhaps some fund managers who started businesses. And I could see that there was a great opportunity to build a new challenger, British asset manager. I had lots of confidence that I could actually do that. I thought I had a very good approach to investing. I thought I had a good approach, which I'd sort of learnt on the job as I was building up Guinness Flight.
Mm.
And so I thought I could do that. The timing was also quite good. We just had the 2003 bear market.
Right.
We were coming out of that. Equities were good value, like to recover. Energy stocks, one of the things that I would, by chance, have started to focus on in 1998, were also quite well priced. The oil price was $25 a barrel. And then, well, so that's why I started it. Perhaps I should go on to then mention that, of course, luck plays a big part in things.
Mm.
And shortly after we started, the SARS crisis in Asia began to wane, and Asian stocks, and one of our funds was which has been there right from the outset, was a China fund,
yeah,
run by one of my colleagues. And that, from the middle of 2003, began to storm ahead. And also the oil price started to go on this journey from 25, it went to $35 a barrel in 2000. So what year am I? Yes. 2003.
Yeah.
2004, it was 45. It got up to about $100 by 2007. So luck played a part.
Okay. Well, it sounds like, well, luck played a part, as you say. But interesting to hear that background. One more to go back a bit further, even. We talked once before, and you told me that when you're at business school, you were looking into the use of data in asset management. And I think this was in the maybe 1970s you were doing that. Can you tell me a bit more about, what you were doing and why, I suppose?
First of all, I must correct you. It was the late 1960s.
Okay.
And yes, I'd read engineering at Cambridge, and then I went straight to MIT, to the business school there. And I, during my first year, I came across two very interesting people.
Mm.
Marvin Minsky, who was very active in the world of artificial intelligence, and trying to teach computers to speak, and also Arne Amstutz, who it's not a name that rolls off the tongue of many people today, but he was right at the forefront of using computers to basically manipulate data on investment management. And that struck me as a very interesting area. It led me to then write a small master's thesis on the use of information technology in investment management. And I think you asked, you know, what did all that mean? What was it all about?
Yeah.
Well, I think there's a bit of a journey here, but we'll start. I think initially, I'm lazy like some other people, and I saw a huge attraction in getting machines to do part of the job that otherwise, you know, analysts were having to do. You know, lots of scribbling and reading and so on.
Slide rules.
And I think that what computers were doing then was they were taking data, back history of 20, 25 years of financial accounting records, share price information, dividends, the price earnings ratio, and manipulating them and being able to present useful tables or useful graphs to help you look at what all this data meant.
Mm.
So that I think was the first thing that I was attracted to, and I then got a job back in London using these skills in corporate finance, and it was very valuable helping one look at what might happen to a company's financial results when it made an acquisition.
Right.
And you made some assumptions on what that would do to margins and so on and projected 2 or 3 years forward. But I want to just go on because things over time, my approach and thinking about the way you can use information technology to benefit investment management has evolved. And when I moved over to investment management, I was from corporate finance. I was struck by the fact that when I was doing corporate finance, I might have 6 weeks to go into an in-depth evaluation of a company and its accounts and so on.
Yeah.
And of course, I thought I knew better than anybody how to do that. Then when I moved over to the investment management side, I came across a completely new problem, that there were so many stocks that you didn't have enough time. I mean, you literally had a universe of 500 stocks, and there were only 220 working days in the year, and you spent half of them doing something else. You only had about an hour per stock. You know, what were you going to do about it? And initially, I suppose, what did the large firms do? They, of course, employed lots of analysts, huge teams of analysts. Well, we weren't a large firm, so we couldn't do that. Well, maybe you look for brokers and see if they're recommending stocks. Maybe you focus on the ones they're recommending or whatever. But after a few years, I had a light bulb moment.
Okay.
And I suddenly realized that you could use information technology to intelligently screen this glut of data that was out there.
Yeah.
You could then prioritize what you looked at. And that really has been the key to how I've been approaching investment management for the last 22 years.
Mm.
Obviously, you then, after you've prioritized what you're going to look at, you can then use the other aspect of information technology to present it very easily. I won't quite say at the press of a button, but you know, to look at the charts and the trends that make you help make you reach the right decision.
Yeah. I suppose if I can ask a kind of follow-up question to that, one of the things about use of data is you know, as soon as one person starts doing something, you might have an edge doing that for a couple of years, but quickly other people will start to copy that kind of practice, right? So I suppose how do you, you know, with your approach to screening, how's it kind of evolved today? And, you know, is there anything that Guinness does that you feel is kind of unique?
Okay. Yes, we have an edge for a bit. I agree. Then we have to accept that others can follow and copy and work it out.
Yeah.
So my I think my main answer is there are many good investors out there. Almost all of them have a different approach to managing investments. the key is they've come up with an approach that works for them, is then to do that approach well.
Yeah.
So that's my rather feeble pushback. We try and do what we're doing well. We have, of course, evolved it. I can sort of give you an example of how we do it. And I don't think anybody looks at investment in the way I'm now going to describe. I may be wrong. We after the 2008 bear market, going back to that first question,
yeah,
we sort of got into a huddle. We were thinking at that moment in time, we had been focused for the previous 10 years or so on energy and renewable energy,
yeah,
and China and innovation. Those were our four things. And in 2010, we were thinking, what do investors actually want now? We enjoy managing those funds, but what do they want?
Yeah.
Maybe they don't want those. And we thought, well, what they want is something that is very well diversified, global. They want it to give them probably a reasonable and growing income. And to be in quality companies that will sail through the next bear market.
Yeah.
And so we thought, well, why don't we come up with a fund that does that? And so we set our intelligent screen now to focus on companies that had a consistently high cash flow return on investment every single year for 10 years in a row. And we then eliminated those that had excessive debt. And we then began to reduced the universe from 8,000 companies with a market capitalization of over 500 million or a billion,
yeah,
about 400. And then we said, let's take that 400 quality companies and look at those that pay a reasonable and potentially growing dividend. That reduced it to 200. And then we said, let's look at that 200 and let's find the 30 or 35 that are the best value. And so we screened for value using various metrics and how sentiment was evolving towards them and so on. And then, of course, we go into our deep dive and we sit around a room and discuss the pros and cons of every investment.
Yeah.
And then eventually we come up with a portfolio. And
that's your global income fund, which is now Guinness's biggest fund.
Exactly.
Hmm.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, thanks, Tim. I mean, maybe, you know, we're running slightly short of time, but maybe if we can quickly come on to the funds that you yourself kind of work closely on, in particular, the Guinness Global Energy Fund, which invests in, you know, mostly oil and gas,
okay. And
then sustainable energy. I mean, in your experience of investing in energy markets, how kind of crazy a moment do you think we're in?
I mean, I'm going to answer that, but I forgot to mention one last thing.
Sure.
About one of the things we do. We do have equal weight portfolios.
Oh, yes.
That's something, again, I got from MIT. It's if you want to reduce stock specific risk to a reasonable level, equal weight portfolios is a good way to go. And I also did, then I was asked, why don't we run our winners and so on?
Yeah.
And I did some research into the merits of running equal weight versus not. And I found some very good research done in the Cass Business School that showed that if you looked in the last 40 years, equal weighted indices had outperformed market cap weighted indices. And actually equal weight was a very good smart beta portfolio construction metric. But anyway, that was that. I just forgot to mention that
earlier. No, thanks, Tim.
Now you were asking crazy energy world.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah, finishing on the note. Yeah, I mean, crazy energy world. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think I wouldn't use the word crazy.
Okay.
Well, not particularly. We are in a world, however, where the cost of energy has jumped back to levels we've sort of seen twice in my lifetime.
Okay.
First of all, we had, and when I say energy the cost of energy has jumped. It's now back at about 12% of GDP. When you add together oil, gas, fossil fuels, and renewables. And it got that high towards the end of the 70s, at the time of the Iranian Revolution and the first Iran-Iraq War. It got quite high in the sort of 2006-07 period, not quite as high as 12%, maybe 10%. And now we're back at 12%. And what I think you can say with some confidence is that this level of energy will cause a recession.
Okay.
How long will it last? Well, I am reasonably sanguine. I think that the energy prices do eventually mean revert to a market clearing level, and that we will see this come down from 12 to maybe 8% of GDP, probably not down to the lower levels that we saw quite a lot of the last 50 years, but that's where it'll go. And I can talk about that if you want. Obviously, within the bigger picture of energy, we just need to make the point that gas is the one area that I might have used the word crazy in.
Right.
Because the spike in the gas price, particularly at some moments in the last summer, was pretty extraordinary.
Right.
That, by the way, one of the reasons for that is that gas doesn't have nearly such a good global market as oil does.
Right. It's much harder to transport.
Yeah, correct. You need pipelines, or you need LNG tankers, and you need the facilities that will gasify or regasify. Or reliquify, sorry. But what I will share with you is something that a lot of people haven't really picked up on. The gas prices actually started because of China's behavior, not Putin's. China had a hissy fit when Australia said, your laboratory in Wuhan has linked the COVID virus. And China said, if you go on saying that, we are going to stop buying your coal. And they did.
I see.
And so they then started scooping up coal from Indonesia and other places and using up their own stocks of coal. They found they were running out and the price of coal was going through the roof. So they started buying gas. So that's what caused the gas price to begin to start moving up. Putin saw this and has then obviously aggravated it quite considerably.
I see.
But I think it will mean revert. I'll just tell you something else about what's going on in Europe.
Yeah.
First of all, gas inventories are now getting back to okay levels because a huge effort has gone into importing LNG. And I think there's a reasonable chance we've now got a gas to see us through the next winter. And meanwhile, nuclear power, people don't talk about this, but it's quite weird. A very high number of French nuclear power stations have been down for the last 6 months because they discovered some corrosion problems.
Okay, I hadn't really come across
about
that.
About 12 months ago. They will come back.
Yeah, and I suppose, well, maybe, if we can finish on a kind of last related note, given you work on both this traditional energy area and sustainability area, I mean, what do you, both of which have been strong performers this year, I would say. Where would you say the best opportunity is at the moment? Where are you kind of looking across those two areas?
I think short term, the best beneficiary is going to be traditional energy.
Okay.
I believe energy prices will take time to subside. One of the things that people need to understand about traditional energy is that supply and demand, both supply and demand, are very inelastic, very price inelastic. You can put the price up and you don't immediately get a surge of new supply and you don't immediately get people cutting their demand. But over time, it happens. Yeah. So the adjustments do occur. Yes, we've got a situation where the rise of electric vehicles is making oil and gas companies pretty cautious about exploration and developing new supply. And you can sort of paint a picture where demand for oil is going to decline as we go the EV route, but so is supply. My suspicion is that the balance will remain reasonably tight. And that, by the way, is what we should all want, because that's a very good thing for helping a reasonable, okay oil price.
Yeah.
Helps the development of renewable energy. That then will lead me on to, I haven't talked about the gas price, but I think, again, that will come back to some sort of normality, because the current price in Europe is absurd compared to the cost of producing it. So there will be efforts to produce more LNG, and America will start exporting quite a lot more. So I then think, however, and I may not have time to get this across, but that sustainable energy, I don't think people properly understand how much investment there is going to be in solar and wind over the next 10 to 15 years. It is huge. There is a, I don't know if you've heard of Chris Goodall. He's written a really great, he's written two really great books, one called The Switch and the second one, What We Should Do Now. But he is painting a picture where we need to move our solar and wind gigawatts installed up about 17 times. And he's got some very good numbers. He explains why as we go to EVs, that pushes our electricity up from 300 terawatts by so much. And then we stop using electricity for steel, that's another chunk. And then when we start using electricity for heating, that's another chunk. And he sees the number of terawatt hours in the UK we will consume going up five times.
Okay.
From 300 terawatt hours to 1500 terawatt hours. And that is going to produce a huge amount of investment. That's a UK example, but it will happen all around the world.
Yeah.
And so so I think sustainable is what then comes second, and it's a pretty good place too.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Tim. On that note, I think we've more or less run out of time. So yeah, thanks very much for coming in today. It was very interesting to learn more about your kind of history in asset management and what you're doing today as well.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. I've enjoyed it very much.
Thank you. And the last thing to say is thank you very much for listening, and please look out for more Funds Fanatic Show podcasts soon.